Hi, and welcome to She's the Boss Leaders, the podcast all about successful female founders and women doing amazing things in business from Australia and around the world. I'm your host, Jules Brooke, and this episode is sponsored by Brand for Brands, a branding agency run by two sisters located in Sydney. They specialize in building and refreshing brands that speak to the right people, the ones that will invest in your products and services. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to She's the Boss, the show that is all about female founders and women doing extraordinary things in business. Now, I'm incredibly excited today because my guest, Nafisa, is amazing. We've had technical issues, so this is our third attempt. So I definitely want to get this story out there because, boy, oh, boy, is she an incredible woman. She's the founder of Animal Works International and Wildwares, and she's an absolute wildlife warrior, and we'll be talking a bit about what she's up to at the moment. She has also won the Archibald Prize, and she's won the gold medal for painting from the Florence Biennale and a million and one other amazing awards for painters. So welcome, Nafisa.
Hi, Jules. Thank you very much for having me.
It is so great to have you. I can't wait to share your story. So let's start with what you're doing now. Do you want to tell everybody a little bit about Animal Works International and what you're doing with to grow this wildlife warrior champion that you are?
Well, yeah, Animal Works International, I founded that back in 2009. And right. It was after I had traveled back to India and had found that there was a real hole in trying to get grassroots projects off and running, like the really big charities that you hear of, like WWF and those I4 and companies like
that.
The
big ones, yeah.
They have a lot of resources, but a lot of their resources also go into the admin and the real estate and so on. And so a small percentage actually goes into the actual project. Whereas when I established Animal Works International, the constitution stipulated that we were not going to spend 1 cent sideways other than it had to go directly into the science or the welfare of the wild animals that we were looking, particularly the endangered species that we were looking to help. So in that case, it was, it was either buying camera traps, it was buying milk for orphan elephants, it was buying emergency rescue vehicles, it was doing things that directly affected the people that were looking after the wild animals, or the carers that we wouldn't pay incentives and we wouldn't pay wages. So it was
amazing because, we often hear about all these charities and a massive amount goes into the wages and admin and not much left to go to the people. So it's brilliant that you're doing it directly. Yeah. But you're doing something very special at the moment. So tell everybody what you're doing with this amazing book that you've created.
Oh, well, the book, okay. So, apart from Animal Works, of course, it's sort of one thing fell into the other. So as we know, We've all been in lockdown for the last year plus. And so at the beginning of last year, we had all the money good to go, and we still do. We raised over 42,000 now for pangolins. Now, pangolins sort of came into the limelight very much over COVID because they were accused of being the incubation animal.
Oh, those animals. Yeah.
Yeah, right. So pangolins. So no one had actually, when we were fundraising for pangolins,
no one had heard of them.
2019, I would say to my friends, look, we're having this big dinner, we're fundraising for pangolins. And they would constantly say to me, I didn't know penguins were even endangered. And we were saying, no, they're not penguins, they're pangolins. So they're a scaled mammal. They're the only scaled mammal in the world. They're basically an anteater.
Yeah.
And they are similar in the situation with a lot of mammals that live both on the Asian on the continent of Asia and the continent of Africa. Yeah. They're much larger in size in Africa, and they're much smaller in size in Asia, because in Asia, like the orangutans that live in the trees and the gorillas that live on the ground in Africa, and orangutans live in the trees in Asia, in Borneo, these animals live in the trees, they're arborists in Asia. So the pangolins are smaller in size and they're easily caught because they're a nocturnal animal. Right. And the minute you touch them or they feel threatened, they'll roll up in a tight little ball and you just have a ball of scales. So they have no predators other than humans.
So it's like a massive Slater.
Yeah, just like a big Slater, basically. And yeah, they're beautiful. And they're absolutely gorgeous looking. They've just got a long little long snout, and they are harmless to everyone because they're anteaters. And these animals have been taken for their scales, so they're the most trafficked animal in the world, and it's basically the Chinese market that demands...
What do they use the scales for?
Oh, you know, decorative elements on your cabinets and jewelry.
God, really?
It's absolutely, and of course,
it's sort of that inlaid stuff that they do.
And it's so sad. And the scales are basically a keratin. So I'll be a little bit graphic here, and I hope you don't mind. But when they take these animals, they remove their scales while they're still alive. So it's like pulling your fingernails out. And then they often eat. They eat the little animal as well, and they just drop them into boiling water for soup. So they're quite horrendous ways. So we've been fundraising. We got the money. And then with COVID, we weren't able to buy the emergency rescue vehicle that Save Our Wildlife Vietnam needed. And we still have the money. And we still also, in the meantime, raised even more money because we wanted to, with this, it's sort of like fortuitous what was happening and it wasn't. We've got all the money good to go. But what happened was that in the meantime, the nutritionist from Taronga here in Sydney, Taronga Zoo in Sydney, Michelle Shaw, she's originally from Canada. She was sent down to South Australia last year, sort of end of 2019 and 2020, to develop a high protein meal for echidnas because ongoing bushfires and so on were really...
Yeah, they're starving.
Yeah, they were starving. They had no ants because of all the trees were burnt up. So she was sent down to Adelaide to work with developing the food. And as a result, this food source would be perfect for pangolins. When they're rescued, what happens, the people who have stolen them or poached them, the poachers, because they sell them to the Chinese by their body weight, they'd often just fill them with corn cement to increase the body weight. So they're starving, basically. So as soon as the rescuers find them, they pump their stomachs free of all this corn cement, which is like poison to them, if they're still alive, of course. And then they've got to give them something nutritious straight away to replenish their condition.
And this food from South Australia solves the problem.
This food is, so Australia's been a massive help in developing even a good food source that will help the pangolins recover and get their condition back when they're found. And we've already earmarked, and we've got $15,000 or $16,000 now aside to buy this millie meal or this particular pangolin meal.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Okay, so talk to me. Tell me, and we'll talk about the book maybe a little bit later because I'd love to get a little bit more into your career. But firstly, what was the reason that you got into wildlife? Why? Because you've had this massive career in art, which we'll talk about in a minute. So what was the light bulb moment or what happened that made you go, no, I want to go and start helping wildlife and supporting wildlife?
Actually, I mean, when I grew up in Hong Kong, so my early years was, growing up in Hong Kong, and my dad was in Air India. He was chief chartered accountant there. So we had an opportunity to travel a lot, and it made me, I suppose, I was felt very grounded as a child because I love travel, but I also had a ongoing weird concern for the planet. So it was always like, where does all of the rubbish come
from? From childhood.
Sorry?
From childhood, way before it was sort of, on everyone else's radar.
Yeah, well, basically when I was about 6, 7 years old, I used the ongoing question I used to give my mother, where does all the rubbish go? Like it was like she's saying, they bury it or they do this. So, and particularly when you're flying into India, because my dad's Indian, used to go to India every year. And of course, you see all the rubbish and you see the poverty.
Everywhere.
And you can't help but be affected from a young child on. Then in Hong Kong, I remember the one moment that I suppose my mother realized that I was going to be a little bit difficult when it comes to wildlife conservation was she sent me down to the markets with the ama, who was, sort of like, the ama around the house. And because I was always itching, I always had ants in my pants and I always had so much energy, and my mum was just go with the ama.
Take it to the market.
And do something. Anyway, so as soon as I saw what was around in the markets, and they had little dogs in cages and cats in cages hanging up. And so I was going, I want one of those dogs. My mum never wanted me to have any animals we had. I think eventually she gave in and got a couple of terrapin turtles out of sheer misery.
Oh, that was it? So you didn't grow up with loads of cats and dogs around?
No animals. Right. I've seen none.
Right. And I was always, you poor thing.
And every single birthday I'd say, Mum would say, you know, what would you like for your birthday? I said, something alive with four legs.
So not a fish, but you wanted a cat or a dog or a rabbit turtle. Or a hamster, yes, or something.
Yeah, I got little terrapin turtles when I was in Hong Kong. But we went to the markets and I point out, and I, you know, I was inconsolable when we got back home. And Mum said to the Amma, what was wrong? And she said, well, you know, Nafisa kept on wanting a dog. And I said, it wouldn't be good for her. And because the dogs that were in the cages, the Amma thought I wanted to have one of those dogs to eat. And because that's what they were being sold for. Right. Yeah, I wanted a dog as a pet. So we were completely on different levels. And when I got back home, my mother was trying to explain to me that I could never have a dog like that because they were considered a food source. And that did it. Like, it was like, well, no, I can't deal with that. So then when we came to Australia, it was very, you know, by that time I was about 11 years old. I was already very interested in, Australia was going to be my favourite place in the world because that's where Skippy came from.
I was a bit the same. I moved here when I was 12 and I couldn't wait to meet Skippy.
I know, that's me too. And we had Skippy in Hong Kong. So I just wanted to come to Australia so I could meet Sunny, marry Sunny and have Skippy as my pet. That didn't work out.
Okay, so that's where, so obviously the love of wildlife has come from a very young age, but let's go back and talk about how your career has unfolded because it's absolutely fascinating what you've been up to. So at school, talk to me about school because did you love it? Did you hate it? And where did you do school? Was that in Hong Kong?
Yeah, school in Hong Kong was very challenging, but, you know, we were, I suppose I was an academic anyway, so I always excelled at that. And so,
which is kind of extraordinary knowing how creative you are that you're an academic as well.
Yeah, well, I suppose
a double whammy.
It's you think of all the Asian kids that come over from Hong Kong from school, you're basically prepared to go, and somewhat driven by the schools. The school system is very, very different. You're not allowed to say a word in class. You know, you have 50 children in the class. The discipline is very, very strong. You know that if you don't do well, by the time you get to sixth class, by the time you're, say, 9 or 10 years old, you will not make it into high school because only a very, very small percentage of children who leave, unless you come from privilege, unless you come from, if you're an expat, if you're attending one of the other schools, I was going to a Chinese Catholic school. So, you know, it was pretty much drilled into me that, like all the other children, my parents didn't send me there for any other reason than my mother was Catholic, is Catholic, so she wanted me to go to a Catholic school. And she didn't want me going to the European school, which was an American-based school. She wanted me to go to something that had a bit of different grounding, I suppose. And I was surrounded by kids who worked very, very hard, and you had to be prepared to be able to run your family business by the time you were 12 years old.
Golly, it's just even as you're saying that, you know, if you complete primary school, it doesn't automatically mean that you'll get into high school. So very strong incentive to excel.
Do really well. And that's why often the Asian children, particularly Chinese children who come over to Australia from Hong Kong or from China, they already have in their heads that they have had to achieve to the levels, the arithmetic and the English, grammar, arithmetic is really at a very, very high standard. By the time you get to the age of 11 or 12 years old, you know, you pretty much can work in your family business. And because that's it, that's your prospects a lot of the time. So when I came to Australia, school was easy, easy peasy.
So because I had exactly the same thing coming from English boarding school. But how old were you when you came here? 11, did you say?
About 11, yeah.
And same as me.
So
so straight into year 7, I guess, in Australia.
Yeah, I pretty much, I did one year of end of primary school, sixth class, and as soon as we arrived here, you know, I was very popular with the school, and I was school captain in Bellevue Hill, and then went straight into high school, and wanted to study, like, you know, wanted to study medicine. That was my absolute focus. I wanted to help people. My academic side was strong, so it was not going to be an issue.
So where was the art in all of this?
I loved art. I did art for the HSC. I came first in New South Wales. I got 150 out of 150. So I was the only person to have ever met full marks in 3 and 5.
So you treated it almost like an academic subject.
I did.
And said, if I'm going to do art, I'm going to have to excel at it.
It was like what all of us businesswomen must do. We have to strategize, right? We have to think, okay, we want to get into this. How are we gonna strategize our strengths, and where are we gonna use our strengths to get us where we wanna go, whatever those strengths might be. You know, you've got to capitalize on
it.
We're women. As women in business, we have to adapt, we've got to change. And you know, you're gonna ask me how I went from medicine into art.
Of course I am.
So it comes with being a female, and we're not set in our ways. We're very adaptable, far, far more than our male counterparts, which often the other gender tends to be often in a path, and because they don't shift as much, they're not as adaptable. They also don't identify with their mothers. Maybe I've identified more with my mother in some ways, which is her adaptability and her accepting change and them accepting travel. When we arrived in Australia, my dad had a wife and 3 kids. My mum wasn't trained in it. She was a domestic engineer.
Yeah.
And $1,200 in his pocket. So, you know, you have
it's hard to believe, isn't it? When you look at your parents, I know my parents came to Australia pretty much the same thing, 4 kids, you know, come out of the army, so no real money.
Yeah.
And they've got to start again. And it's very empowering to kind of watch them adapt and grow. But, okay, so you finished school, obviously, ducks of the school or whatever it was.
Yep.
How did you go into medicine first?
I went into New South Wales Uni, and I was pretty young. I was only 16, 9 months when I started, so I wasn't even 17. So,
wow.
You know, no drinking, nothing like that. So I was very, very studious. And
what did you, was that for medicine? Did you go to uni to do medicine?
Yes, I got into medicine either Sydney or uni, New South Wales, but I chose New South Wales because at that time it had a more progressive course. And after doing 3.5 years, and really, I really wanted to do microsurgery because of my, my art even featured in there. I loved studying anatomy. I loved microbiology. I loved histology. I loved looking at anything with a microscope. I really enjoyed that side of it. I didn't enjoy the pharmacology as much, or the pathology side. So after 3.5 years, I deferred and I never went back. And
hang on. What did your parents say when you say 3.5 years into a medical degree, I'm going to drop out for a year?
Well, that's the interesting thing, because if you are paying your own way and you're living on your own, they don't have much say. I moved out when I was 17. So I moved out because the situation at home was I had a not happy relationship with my younger brother who didn't like me studying. He used to turn the music up loud. He used to just annoy the crap out of me pretty much. So he was 5 years my junior. So I thought, right, I have to move out and really focus on my study, because I had a hard enough time. I mean, when I was studying for the HSC, every single afternoon I religiously would come home, dump my bags and cycle back to the library and spend 5 hours solidly studying at the library and then cycle back home.
Oh, my God.
And that was just...
You are so driven.
Yeah, driven, yeah.
Yeah, really. So 3 years of medical school, you drop out to do what? What were you thinking you'd like to do?
At that time, I got married, and my husband we'd met through medicine, so we'd been together for like 6 years, 6.5 years as students, and we got married, and I started a fashion business. So the fashion business was completely different. It was creative, because he said, look, just do what you want. Why don't you go and just paint? You're a good artist. Why don't you paint? And I said, well, no, I don't really have anything to say. Now, that is one of the big differences between, I think, someone who goes into art as a very young age, might want to use their art to elicit change or to say something. And if you haven't developed that side of you that actually knows how to articulate what the sort of change you want to see driven, then you might just go into art and just be carried along by whatever's going on. Now, at that time, we're talking about 1980s, abstract art was all the thing. I didn't like abstract art at all. I was very much aspiring always to the old masters. So Salvatore Dali was about as a modern master as I could imagine me aspiring to.
Right.
Yeah, so I went into fashion. I started a fitness and swimwear company and it did really, really well. I did that for 10 years.
Did you do the designs?
Yeah, I designed the garments. You know, aerobics was all the rage. I was designing very much.
Thank you, Olivia Newton-John.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing was, the reason I liked it was just I found that the fashion that was being driven once again was male-driven. Brian Rochford was the fashion label. It was driven by guys, and it was designed. A lot of the fashion labels that time were still designed by men, and I didn't think they actually capitalized on the female form. And here I was, having studied anatomy, knowing the female form, also being very, very capable as an artist to draw the nude.
Artist and designer, yeah.
Yeah, it was going to be pretty easy for me to fashion garments that were going to be highlighting women's assets and playing down the flaws in our figures. So,
right. How fascinating. I just think that's amazing. So you started a fashion label. How did it go?
It went really well.
I mean, there's a whole lot of other stuff that surrounds fashion. I mean, you've got to do all the business side of it, the marketing.
Yeah. It's,
how did you go with all of that?
I did it all on my own, funnily enough. It was like I was one. In fact, it was so full on. Like after, I think I'd been running it for about 7 years by this stage, and the ATO came to audit me, and I was scared, absolutely scared to, you know, like not knowing what was going on. I asked my dad, who's an accountant, he ran his own accountancy business here, and I said, "Dad, the ATO are coming to inspect me or something." He said, "Don't worry." And he said, "It's just that because you've had a turnover of, $800,000 this year, and you're a one person operation, and they can't believe you can do it. So just sit down with them, tell them exactly what you do, show them your place, and they'll believe you because you'll be telling the truth." And they came in, they said, and they couldn't work out how I could do the design. I could go to Italy, buy the fabrics, which I was doing. I was going to Milan for a week every year, choose the fabrics, come back, design all the garments, do the whole photo shoot. I'd have a photographer, I'd get the models, I'd design all the garments, then do all the marketing. Then I'd go to all the states. So I'd go to Perth. I wouldn't go to Northern Territory, but Perth, Brisbane, you know, Queensland. I was to travel across
New Zealand. And go and sell it in.
Yeah, do all the sales and plus the marketing, and then see all the gyms. As soon as I'd covered the states, I'd then do department stores. So I had Myers and Daimaru as well as clients, and I was exporting.
Wow, Nafisa, amazing.
But they couldn't believe it. They basically, that's why they went to audit me. And then as soon as the guy came in, I could articulate every aspect of the business. I could tell them what was done, how it was done, you know, everything. They went, "Yep, I think you actually run the whole business yourself." So it was.
That is incredible. So why did you leave fashion? What prompted a move after that?
I think after fashion, it was just not. It was creative, but aerobics was changing. We were getting back into gyms were bringing machines in, and as soon as that came in, it signals. And one thing is about, once again, to be adaptable in your business is a strong point. Sometimes if you grow too big, it's like turning the Titanic. You know, you can turn a small boat around really quickly, but you try and turn the Titanic and it'll take a long time to shift out of a mess. And in that time, when machines were coming in, everyone was encouraged to join a gym and just wear a t-shirt and shorts. Don't worry about aerobic wear.
Right.
Don't worry about.
So that was
the shift, and that signaled an exit for me out of that business. And I was.
Did you sell it, or did you just close it down?
No, I tried to sell it. It was doing really well, but once again, Jules, you know, you're trying to sell a one-man show, and the people that were interested in the business were women who wanted to work it with their girlfriend, and it was going to be a lot of work. And you start at 6 o'clock in the morning and you don't finish till midnight. It sounds glamorous. It's not. It's really hard work. And no one really could get their head around the amount of work that it would entail. And so I just wound it up and went, you know what? it achieved what I set out to achieve.
Right. So what was next? What did you leave it and decide to do?
Well, it was I was winding it down because I could see it wasn't selling. And in the meantime, the other side of the business, which was designing garments for people like Gladiators when the Gladiators program was on.
Oh, my God. Yes.
You know what I mean.
You did those outfits.
And I was also designing garments for all the grid girls, like when Peter Jackson, Benson Hedges, all these cigarette companies had their notoriety associated with car and motorbike races, you know, all the Grand Prix.
Yeah.
So I used to design all the grid girls' costumes in Lycra. So they would be, you know, you're talking about 6 foot plus models, tall blondes often, and they'd be in completely body hugging garments that was there completely just as eye candy for the population who were watching, largely male.
Right. So, yeah, of course.
So I just would do that. And, you know, there was a hell of a lot of money involved in that. So as I was winding down the fitness wear, that area was picking up. And at that point, my first husband and I split up, of course, very early on in our piece, but I'd been with my second husband for quite some time. We had a lovely relationship. We were working very, very hard at renovating houses. He's a civil engineer. And he said, look, yeah, just if you want to give this up, fine, go towards and do a bit of your art as such. And so I enrolled into Julie Nashton Art School. I got a full scholarship to be in Julie Nashton Art School, and my art career took off.
Which art school did you say?
Julian Ashton Art School. Julian Ashton was a very well-known Australian painter in the late 19th, early 20th century. So Julian Ashton Art School is an atelier art school in Sydney. It's based in the Rocks, and his great-great-grandson, Paul Del Pratt, still runs it. And so it has a beautiful history. It's an atelier art school. They basically teach the skills. It's a skill-based school. They teach the old-fashioned schools of old masters' work. So you have to learn about the skeleton. You have to learn about life drawing.
You would have been in heaven.
Yeah, very much. I'd always wanted to go there. And then when I thought, right, I'm going to go there, and that's the beginning of, I thought, right, I really have a lot to say, and now I want to become a full-time artist.
Right. So tell me a little bit about what life is like when you decide to become a full-time artist. How did you get to Archibald Prize and the Florence Biennale gold medal? How did those happen?
It was going back to what I was saying right at the beginning is, you know, we're adaptable. So a lot of people would find, and I know I've seen it happen in numerous friends of mine where, and it's usually, once again, usually male, when they're leading one career and then they think they've got to reinvent themselves to another career, they don't cope very well. But, you know, if you're thinking I was well known in my industry, in fitness wear, in fashion, I had a good reputation there, delivered a very, very high quality product. It was, you know, where fitness wear was on average $38 a garment. Mine was $78 a garment, like it was double the price retail. And we had were always having sellouts. And I went from that industry into an industry which I was totally unknown. I came in as a complete unknown. I was okay with that because it comes down to having a certain sense of confidence in myself and thinking, well, I've just got to work hard. And I think women...
And you know how to do that.
Yeah, and you just start. It's just like another startup, isn't it? It's another startup. You're thinking, how am I going to do this? Who am I going to...
But not very much. I wouldn't think very many artists think that way. And also you obviously had that business ability, which is also, in my experience from all the artists I know, missing from a lot of them. So you were kind of an interesting person to go and study something like this. But so what was your strategy then? I mean, you're unknown in the art world, and you're starting again a new career, which I always find incredibly exciting. What was your, you know, strategy? How did you think you were going to manage to turn it into a career?
Well, first of all, I was labelled very much. It was a male institution. Julian Ashton Art School is a male institution. They absolutely favour the boys who turn up there to learn, and women and me. So I was born in 1963. So by the time I started, 1998 and 1999, I was considered a middle-aged female, a bored housewife, you know, ticked in that type of situation. And it didn't make for a happy start going into art, because I thought, why are we being labelled? Why are women being labelled? We can achieve so much. We can achieve anything we want when we put our minds to it. And why is it that because I want to start now, when I feel like I've actually got something to say, why should we be put behind the 22-year-old guys who are starting in this industry?
They've got nothing to say, really.
And so what happened was pretty much I went, right, okay, I'm going to set myself a goal. I finished I got my scholarship by 2000, year 2000, I basically started what I consider my professional career, and I set myself a 10-year goal. And there are goals that we can set ourselves any time of our lives, and some of them work out and some of them don't. The 10-year goal to me seemed pretty feasible, because I thought, okay, by 2010, I want to be an artist. I don't want to be well known for just being well known for being a celebrity or anything like that. I want to be well known in amongst my art, with my art peers, as a very, very good artist. And so I want to be recognized for my work.
I don't want to interrupt you, but wasn't this the time of Ken Dunn and artists kind of commercializing their stuff?
Absolutely.
Was that not around that time?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you didn't think that model was the way to go?
I didn't identify myself with that. I wanted to be an artist. There's artists that have gone on and become very famous for being running their work commercially, and also not even a commercial side of it. I know Ken and I respect his work very much, because, you know, Judy, his wife, has been the driving force behind Ken's commercial side. He also attended National Art School. I did my master's at National Art School a few years later, but I've met him and we had a good chat. In fact, I did his portrait. I've got a lovely portrait of him that he loves.
Wow.
So I know Ken very well, and he could paint like an angel. He could draw like an angel. His work is, you know, very, very realist. When he started at National Art School, he chose to go down because he found himself appealing and a style.
That he liked.
Yeah. And I think, and I had a chat once, I knew Brett Whiteley's mother, Beryl Whiteley.
Right.
And we used to go out, I used to take her out sometimes for tea and out to the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and because she was very elderly, but she had a mind as sharp as anything. And, you know, by 5 o'clock in the morning, she'd read all the newspapers, had been listening to the BBC, and she knew everything.
That's amazing.
And so I remember one time, it was about 2004, 2005, and I said, look, you know, I'd just been hung in the Dobell Art Prize. So I was a finalist in the Dobell at Art Gallery of New South Wales, and I'd been doing a lot of drawing.
Incredible.
And I said, oh, my painting's a bit flat and I just don't know what I'm going to do. And she said, I remember her saying, look, I say to Brett that just stop painting, just draw. Just draw for a while. And so at that time, I remember taking like 6 or 7 months out to just draw.
And did it make a big difference?
It made a big difference because it focused once again, what did I want to do? And I think that also fed a lot back into my wildlife conservation work, because in that time of just drawing, I created a piece called Crying for Future, which was a 5-meter long drawing of 120 portraits of animals. And it was just drawing.
Wow.
It was just...
Where is it now? Did that get sold? Is that in a gallery somewhere?
I have it as prints. It's available as prints on my website.
Okay.
Which is nafisa.com.au.
That's incredible.
But the original went missing, actually. It's stolen.
It's
a weird story behind that. But it was meant to go up to the Australia Zoo, to Steve Irwin Zoo. And I had a friend in Brisbane, and she said, send it up to me. I'll look after it. She, you know, I did. And in the meantime, this very dear friend of mine passed away, and her husband of 4 years disappeared with it. We don't know where it is at the moment, but we know that he's got it. So if it ever comes up, you know, in the meantime,
it's yours.
I'm not worried about it because it was professionally scanned. We have a record of it. A 4-meter print of it sits in the boardroom at Taronga Zoo. Cameron Kerr loves it. And I'm friends with Cam, who's a director.
Amazing.
So, yes.
Okay. So tell me a little bit more about this art career, though. So, I just love the way your brain works, because it's really unusual, I think.
So, as an artist functioning on a business brain, well, then you're going to be, once again, you're going to be setting your goals. And if you follow those goals, and you make your timeline. I say it's in a way like planning a wedding, you know, because that relates to women. It's like planning a wedding. You go, okay, how many years out is, you know, if you're going to plan a wedding and it's going to be in a year's time, when do the invites have got to go out? When have got the, when's the dress got
to
be?
Oh, you like to that extent you went, okay, I've got to win this prize at this time.
And, yeah, pretty much.
You know, I had a kind of structure.
I thought by 2010, I need to win an Australia recognized art prize. Before that, I need to achieve a whole lot of other goals, a whole lot of other prizes. And I probably need to do a postgrad degree in fine art to be recognized and considered equal to my male counterparts who don't have a degree, because that's what us women have to do. We have got to sometimes
excel that little bit more.
Yeah. And just to be taken seriously, I thought, well, I'm not getting taken seriously. By 2004, 2005, I was exhibiting. I had solo exhibitions. I'd founded a National Association of Portrait Artists in 2002. So I was helping other artists on that platform of portraiture.
Yeah.
Even my solo exhibition in 2004, I had Dr. Carl open it for me. I was connected, and yet I wasn't being hung in those art prizes that I wanted to be hung in.
Right. So, and the art you were applying for them.
Well, I think it was I felt it was a bit of a club, and I think I was probably right in thinking that.
So you probably were a bit of a boys' club, as you've said, from Julian Ashton. So, you know, it is in almost every industry, I think. So talk to me about the Archibald, sorry.
Yeah, so the club, so I thought, okay, if I go and start doing a postgrad, because I applied to National Art School to do a master's degree. They wanted me to do an undergrad first, and I said, look, I think I've done enough art history and enough coursework, and they wanted me to do a coursework. Bernard Ollis was very much on my side. He said, look, I think she can quite capably handle herself doing a postgrad with just without coursework, with a thesis.
Yeah.
They liked my proposal for a thesis very much, which was called Portraiture and the Identity, or Identity and the Portrait, which was about how identity and portraiture are linked but not necessarily the same thing. How we present ourselves in a portrait is actually not necessarily how the artist sees the person, but it has to be a collaboration. And often it ends up, particularly in a commission situation, it ends up that the subject ends up dictating how they want to be presented to the world.
Yeah, so of course, that makes sense.
Yeah, and
for the artist who has been commissioned, they want the owner to buy it, I guess.
A commission starts with
they're going to do what they're asked.
Yeah, a commission starts with the subject saying to the artist of choice, "I want you to do my portrait. Here's the deposit," type thing, or here's a deposit for your fee. Whereas my choice, my paintings, my award-winning paintings, I should say, you know, because I was a finalist in the Portuguese. I won a certificate of merit over in the US in New York at the Met for a painting of Salvatore Zafreia, who's an artist here. These portraits are of people I chose to paint, not commissions.
And the Archibald Prize winner that you did, was that Maria Venuti? Was that you?
No, I did paint a portrait of Maria Venuti. That was hung in the Salon des Refusés in 2005. So I was getting very close in the salon. But, it was a portrait of Glen A. Baker. It was a big
one. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Glen A. Baker, fantastic. Okay, so... So talk to me a little bit about how far you went with your art career, and then what was the next one?
Well,
at the end of the 10 years.
Well, once again, it goes to your adaptability, and it goes down to what you're basing your credentials. So unbeknown to me, I would see these biennales and, you know, I'd hear about these biennales. What's a biennale? It's a collection of artists showing their work at a particular venue.
Okay.
And I suddenly, as soon as I started my master's degree in the beginning of 2005, I appeared on the radar for international biennales, which I didn't know that was even a thing, right?
Right.
So I'm just letting people know that if you really want to get out there and be on an international platform, funnily enough, once you start building up your, it's like anything, you build up your credibility, you build up your profile.
Yeah,
but also by doing courses or by hanging another set of letters, whatever it might be, on your name. Doesn't matter what age you want to do that, because I've known friends to want to do a master's degree in, you know, in their 60s, they'll still do it. And then suddenly start getting asked about doing things, or you know, you might do a PhD at the age of 65.
Right. So what you're saying is if you work your way up and you build a reputation, and then suddenly you're on the radar and you're getting invited as opposed to having to go out and find them.
And to be asked to do things. And it's interesting because as soon as I signed up to do my master's degree and I was in it, I was invited to attend the Florence Biennale in end of 2005. And at that time I took over a bunch of little five-sided portraits, which was part of my master's proposal. So I wanted to be over there in the area of painting, but the way I presented my work, the judges over there deemed it an installation. So I ended up winning a bronze medal for installation rather than what I was pitching for, which was painting.
But you did win a gold medal for painting in the end.
Well, I did. 2 years later, I was invited to go back.
You just don't give up.
Well, it was just also that they invited me back because all the medal winners were automatically invited back to the next Biennale.
Right. And by then, I guess you understood what they were actually looking for.
Yes. And so I thought, they
want stay paintings. Away from installations.
Yeah, well, when they said they wanted paintings, I thought, I'll give them a painting. So I did a 6-meter mural. They got a big painting.
6 meters.
Well, it was Australian wildflowers. I wanted it to be celebrating Australia because the first entry, of course, was Australian faces because I did all these family and friends, 60 little portraits, and I was celebrating our diversity. So it was really about saying, look at us. We are so diverse in our nationality, in our ethnicity, in our culture. And then it got recognized and people got the message that came through very strongly in my installation. And then when I went back there, I really wanted to celebrate our beautiful wild wilderness, which as I'm a diver, I wanted to take on the colours of the Great Barrier Reef. So the 6-meter mural was celebrating our beautiful wildflowers and the colours of our cobalt waters. And
that was incredible.
And that won the gold medal from the Florence Biennale.
And so was the Florence Biennale the culmination of your career, or did you keep going? The Archibald Prize came after that. I'm interested as to at what stage you decided, okay, that career is done, on to the next one.
Yeah, well, it's I suppose the Florence Biennale was this other thing in my head that I'd been watching so many, and this is very, very, we're all aware, so much talent in Australia is exported.
Yes.
And only when we bring it back here, then we recognise it. And how true is that about so many of our actors, so many of our musicians?
I hadn't really thought about
so many of our singers. You know, you look at people like Tina Arena, she's got the most amazing voice. And she only started really getting recognised when she went over to Italy and spent a lot of time overseas. She's a phenomenon overseas, and yet we still, I don't think, really pay her the respect that she is due.
No, she's still tiny Tina Arena to us from young talent time or whatever. Whereas in France, I think she's like a national treasure.
Exactly. So once again, it's that whole, you know, dichotomy that happens. It's not fair that people have, we've got a tall poppy syndrome in Australia that sometimes is a good driver. There's a silver lining that it drives people here to go, okay, fine, well, I'm going to go overseas, and then maybe overseas will recognize me, and then suddenly you come back and you're more recognized here. That was basically what drove me. I went, well, I can't get hung over here. I'm going to go overseas and be, you know, recognized the gold medal in Italy, in the Florence Biennale, that really opened a lot of eyes over there, because it was from, you know, 600, from 800 artists from 60 countries or something. It was like a phenomenal thing to be considered. And
you're absolutely incredible, Nafisa. You really are.
But it's not recognised here. I came back and I still couldn't get hung in a gallery. I applied in the beginning of 2008, I applied to 23 Sydney galleries, and I got rejected by 23 Sydney galleries. So it's it still didn't,
after winning that prize.
Yeah, it still didn't, you know, win any, you know, it still was struggling.
Cut through the elitism. It wouldn't cut through that elitism in the in the art community, obviously.
But I had done I got my master's degree, and then suddenly you're in the club for the Australian area. So Then in 2008, I won the Perth Portrait Prize with a portrait of Lewis Morley, who was a very, very celebrated Australian photographer. He was now in his 80s.
Okay.
And, you know, he did the very famous black and white photograph of Christine Keeler, the nude sitting on a
heart. Right, yes, yes,
yeah,
okay.
That's Lewis Morley. And so when I met him, I was fascinated by his history. He'd been a prisoner of war in China, in the camps over there. He was incredible. Half Chinese, half British, came over here. Fascinating story, absolutely amazing
movie. Yeah.
And now in his 80s, well, he passed away a couple of years ago, but at that time in his 80s, he was going to launch a new career in assemblage, which was really amusing because he was a photographer.
But, I love anybody who thinks about starting a career anytime after 70 is pretty cool to me.
So he was an inspiration. So, he was definitely an inspiration.
All right. So incredible. So look, we've got about 10 minutes left. Take me up to today and what you're doing today and the book that I'm dying for you to show everyone.
Okay, so I'll cut.
So what happened? But
So 2020, as we all know, just seemed to disappear. But it was actually 2020 that got me doing what I'm doing today. So it's a complete segue into it, because when I couldn't do anything with the pangolins and I was so frustrated, thinking, here we are, the whole world is shutting down, we need to look after our wilderness. Our wilderness was hammered in Australia, of course, by the fires. As a result, we got this fantastic opportunity to come up with some food for pangolins, as much as they're in Vietnam and they're being poached out of Africa as well now. But, you know, there was that opportunity. I said, right, you know, we're shut down. Vietnam was being hammered. Hanoi in the north was where we were going to have to purchase the emergency rescue vehicle. Save Our Wildlife Vietnam, the people in the south, they would have to make a six-hour, almost impossible journey to get to Hanoi, because 6 hours is a long way through jungle and so on to get to Hanoi.
Absolutely.
And they still haven't been able to purchase an emergency rescue vehicle. That project is still there, and we are hoping to have it realized in the next month or two, because we're now back in communication with them. So as things are opening up, we're really happy, because we're going to actually be able to achieve our goal. But when in March last year, in the meantime, I launched. So a girlfriend of mine and I came up with this concept of Wildwares. Wildwares was going to be a product to help wildlife conservation. Funnily enough, we had no idea COVID was around the corner. So we came up with this in October 2019. We went to launch it at the Reed's Gift Fair in Sydney in 2020, end of February.
And we're going to be participating
in the Reed's Gift Fair in July in Melbourne, which got shut down. Wildwares.
But tell me, what was Wildlife Wares?
Wildwares are anything to do with homewares that helps wildlife conservation. And our launching product is and has been camphor laurel cutting boards. So if you look up Wildwares, they're camphor laurel cutting boards. Therefore, they're a pest. Camphor laurels are a pest in Australia. They're an introduced species. They compete with our eucalypt trees. Therefore, they compete with the trees that koalas and our wildlife needs to exist. And they're big shade trees. They were introduced here for shade. And they're a pest, and they smell, they make, you know, they're camphor, so they have inherently in the wood, they're antibacterial, so no bacteria can exist in camphor laurel cutting boards. So they're the best type of cutting board you can have, and we were putting my engravings of my wildlife animals and drawings engraved onto the boards,
and you're still selling them. So
yes, if you go onto Wildwares, you'll find us. We have a Facebook page, we have an Instagram page, and they're beautiful boards, and we're very proud of them, because they will never be landfill. That's number one. They'll never be landfill. They are eco-friendly, and 20% of all of our profits go straight back to Animal Works. Sustainability.
And can I just ask, I should have said something earlier, the art behind you, I assume that's yours as well, is it?
Yeah, this is to do with my book. So COVID prompted me to sit down and think, what now? Like, my gallery, I was going to be selling my gallery. My gallery was up for sale. I have now moved out of that. And COVID shut everything down that we could, I could exist as an artist. So I was working from home and I thought, right now I'm going to launch this book. This book that was originally a journal of my drawings, of 90 drawings that I'd drawn into while I had gone, where I'd been traveling up and down to Florence and Tuscany. I wanted it to be realized as a book. So I worked very, very hard on COVID once again, you know, take the opportunity, be adaptable.
Oh, so you did, you drew all these pictures in COVID?
Sorry?
Or no, the picture, did you draw the
book?
No, the art was there before.
Yes, but I turned it into a book. So I then turned it.
So, look at that. Gorgeous.
So this is the original, these are the original drawings all in watercolour and pen ink and.
And then is there a little story beside on the, I can see there's some writing. Is that the story of what influenced the image?
Exactly. So these were the original drawings in a journal, but this book now is a publication called Tuscan Temptations.
Tuscan Temptations. And fantastic. And that's available for people to buy and the money goes towards
this is a really expensive edition. This is digitally printed in Australia because we have no offset printing in Australia. So this is digitally printed in Australia. You can contact me if you want to buy the book. You have to email me. So it's nafisa.naomi@me.com or go to my website.
Right. And when you say they're really expensive, how much are they?
$500.
Oh, no, but I mean for individually.
Well, it's just, it's like a collectible. It's a collectible. They're all signed and numbered. They're on art paper. Each and every single one of these pages is hand-torn, so it's a completely hand-torn book on the non-bound edge.
Gorgeous.
I'm very proud of it. It has, like, silk ribbon markers. It's got a faux leather.
It looks stunning.
And it comes in because, and I timed the launch. So I had the launch just last a couple of weeks ago in.
So we just put dates in, though.
Okay.
I'm not sure when this will come out.
Launch was done in March, but it's to commemorate the reason I wanted this book to happen this year and to come out this year because I created a commemorative bag and it's
gorgeous.
Commemorating, that's one of the drawings in the book, but it's commemorating the 160th anniversary of the unification of Italy. So Italy has been unified under one flag for 160 years in 2021. And that
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So in 1861, all the provinces of Italy came together and this was the 160th anniversary. And I thought, right, last March, April, I went, I need to get this work created into a book. And the journal is one journal. But now the narrative was already written. I just needed to formulate it, get it into a book format, choosing the lining. And you can imagine how difficult during COVID to get any samples from anywhere.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
But it worked. We were working to tight deadlines. It went to print in December and we pushed out because of COVID, we had to push out the date of launch. We were going to do it in October, November. And then with COVID, we just thought this is not going to work. Let's push it out to March, which would be safer. And in the meantime, I looked at the date and March 17th is actually the date of the unification of Italy, the anniversary date.
Wow, which is really funny because I only ever think of it as St. Patrick's Day.
Exactly, that's what everyone said. Hey, it's St. Patrick's Day. Yeah, well,
it's also the unification Italy. Day. Well, that's amazing. Nafisa, we have to finish this up because we've run out of time and I could talk to you for ages and ages, but just tell anyone who's watching, what is the best way to get hold of you? What's the best way they can support your wildlife initiatives?
Okay, so anyone who's interested in what I do with Animal Works, it's animalworksinternational.org. Go on to that website, look up Animal Works, join our Facebook. We have a Facebook page. We've got an Instagram page. 100% of the money we raise goes to wildlife conservation projects. We've raised well over $500,000 so far, and that's just by doing things like putting on dinners and events, and a lot of my art gets sold to help wildlife conservation. You can get hold of me through my website, just www.nafisa.com.au, or email me on nafisa.naomi@me.com.
Great.
I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to hear your feedback. But I just really thank you, Jules, because you're giving women an opportunity to give our story, but also to remind each other how just a lot of driven hard work and a lot of resilience gets us through.
And what it can do, that's right. And I mean, my goal is just to shine the light on amazing people, and you are definitely one of those amazing people. So thank you so much for sharing your story with me. It is incredible. I'm hoping that by the time this comes out, we'll have done some posts about your animal wares on and what you're up to and the book on the She's the Boss page. But thank you so much for sharing your journey with me.
Thanks so much, Jules.
My pleasure. If you've enjoyed this episode and you would like to hear a bit more, then go to the YouTube channel and subscribe, and you'll be able to see all of the interviews that we've got. I hope you've enjoyed this one, and I look forward to sharing some more stories with you in some of the other episodes. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this episode. Another big thank you to our sponsor, Brand for Brands Agency. To find out more about Brand for Brands, go to brand4brands.com. To watch this or any other episodes in this series on video, go to the She's the Boss YouTube channel. And to find out all about She's the Boss, how we are making female founders more visible and lifting up the women around us, go to shesthebossgroup.com.